It was almost as if Jesus was preparing me or informing me that I would be continuing this way of bearing my cross and that it would continue to entail suffering after I got back home. But there was a real sense Jesus wouldn't leave me, that he would continue to help me bear my cross. And there was a deep peace with that.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. Today on In Good Faith, we'll be discussing a topic we really felt drawn to with James Patrick Thomas, the author of Atomic Pilgrim: How Walking Thousands of Miles for Peace Led to Uncovering Some of America's Darkest Nuclear Secrets. Jim shares that he was walking for peace and nuclear disarmament in the early 1980s, which happened to be at the same time the leadership of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints released a statement against the Reagan-era MX nuclear missile system that the federal government wanted to locate in Utah. Those leaders wrote, quote, "We repeat our warnings against the terrifying arms race in which the nations of the earth are presently engaged. We deplore in particular the building of vast arsenals of nuclear weaponry. Our fathers came to this western area to establish a base from which to carry the gospel of peace to the peoples of the earth. It is ironic and a denial of the very essence of that gospel that in this same general area there should be constructed a mammoth weapons system potentially capable of destroying much of civilization." So we'll be hearing from a cradle Catholic moved by his faith and love for God to join in the worldwide activism against nuclear war and armament. James Patrick Thomas serves on Pax Christi USA's Disarmament Working Group and facilitates the Pax Christi chapter at St. Joseph Parish in Seattle. He began advocating for nuclear disarmament in the 1980s as a member of the Bethlehem Peace Pilgrimage. He spent the next quarter century investigating radioactive pollution from the production and testing of nuclear weapons, mostly focused on the Hanford site in south-central Washington state.
So this is back when I was working at a job in television in Spokane, and the night was a Monday evening in January of 1981, and it was a documentary on Mother Teresa. She had just won a year or two before the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in Calcutta, and I can't remember the exact question that the reporter posed to her. It was something like, "How do you know if you're doing God's will?" But I'll never forget what Mother Teresa said. And she said, "Love until it hurts." And I had a feeling down deep in my gut that, oh my gosh, my life has just changed. And this phrase, "love until it hurts," is all about giving of ourselves, of surrendering our lives to God and living for others, not just living for ourselves, but living for others. And I guess, you know, as I was in my mid-20s, I had been trying to make happiness in living for myself, but it struck me that what I needed to do now was to volunteer, to literally give of myself. I had known about the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, and I had known some friends of mine from high school who had done that. And so the next day, I applied to the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And by August, I was working in the inner cities of Seattle.
Well, when you talk about reading that quote from Mother Teresa, if I can now quote you to you, you say, "I felt this churning deep in my gut. I went into my bedroom and grabbed my journal and a pencil. I flipped past entries about growing dissatisfaction with my job, then sat on the floor and tried to make sense of what all this meant." I think lots of us relate to those moments where we think, what am I doing with my life? Does it matter what I'm doing? Am I making a positive difference for other people? I definitely don't think you're alone in that, but it seems like it was a very dramatic turning point for you.
It totally changed my life. I was frustrated in my job, and that, along with the turmoil that was going on in Central America in the early 1980s with the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero and other priests and church workers, seemed to have a disconnect between what I hoped to do with my life and what I was actually doing at the TV station. I felt almost as if I was part of the problem as opposed to part of the solution.
Talk to me about, you call this Atomic Pilgrim. So go ahead and explain that to listeners. Why that title?
You know, there was that one event in January of 81 about Mother Teresa, but there was another significant event that same year in October. So I'd been here in Seattle with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps for a few months, but there was a presentation by Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, and they were advocating for nuclear disarmament because physicians couldn't help in the aftermath of an atomic attack because everything is blown away, devastated, impossible for first responders to make it to victims. And it was followed by a pantomime about the nuclear arms race called 4 Minutes to Midnight, a reference to the doomsday clock by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And it was at that time, it was pointed at 4 Minutes to Midnight. The pantomime broke through, and without words, I was forced to confront the reality that we are on the precipice of destroying the world with nuclear weapons on an emotional basis. Well, it threw me into a very deep depression that lasted a couple of weeks. And as I explained in the book, what any good Catholic does when confronted with a similar kind of situation, you go to see a priest. Well, in this case, the priest was Father Jack Morris, who had thought of the idea of walking to Bethlehem for peace. And Jack really challenged me. He said, in order for you to get out of this depression, you need to be involved. You need to do something for peace. If you sit and wallow, you're just going to stay in that. It's only by doing something positive about the nuclear threat that you'll be healed. And so he invited me to join the pilgrimage, and I wasn't up for that yet because it was very intimidating to me, the thought of walking halfway across the world, 15 to 20 miles a day, and not knowing where the next meal was going to, not knowing where he's going to sleep, not knowing when I'd be able to have a shower even. But I started to help organize the pilgrimage. We were about a year and a half in preparation before we left. And part of the thing of it being a pilgrimage, it wasn't just a protest march. It wasn't just a call for nuclear disarmament, although it's certainly that. Especially in the early 1980s, we had over 70,000 nuclear weapons in the world, most between the United States and the Soviet Union. And we'd been at it for 40 years. And it was a problem bigger than any of us. And we knew that we needed God's help. We needed the help of the world religions. And that's what our original mission was, to call forth a worldwide assembly of religious leaders to outlaw war. Not just nuclear weapons, but outlaw war.
A pilgrimage to me seems like you do have a destination, but also it's a way of searching for meaning or maybe making meaning. And I'm wondering, I read that there were over 400 places that you stopped along the way. And as you came into a place and a church or some community group would take you in and give you food, all of those kind of things, what was it you would share with them? Or were they already apprised of your mission to the point that they were just, yes, we're here in solidarity? Was there something you would do together with local people as you went along? I know some even joined you for a day or a week to march with you.
Or an hour. It varied. Some people would just walk us to the edge of town and turn around and come back. Our outreach was mostly to churches. We also reached out to other religious groups when those opportunities presented themselves, but most of it was just to people in churches. But we met with religious leaders as much as we could. But most of the time, it was in small towns. Most of the space between large cities is small towns or rural areas. And I remember this one town, I think it was Holbrook in southern Idaho, and it was a conservative town. And we went up to them and asked them if we could stay there for a night. And they were a little skeptical. I mean, we're kind of a ragtag group. We ranged in age from 20 to 67. And people in small town have a good sense, maybe not fear, but wariness of strangers. And yet we went up to them and they told us later that the reason why they didn't tell us that we couldn't stay there is they didn't want to take a chance of saying no to Jesus. They saw it as an opportunity to be Christian people and say, I want to meet the Jesus in you.
That's really beautiful. How did your parents feel about this when you said, guess what I'm going to do?
I don't remember much about what my dad felt. I know my mom was really quite upset. She knew how hard I had worked during college and afterwards to get this job in television and to throw that away. And she didn't like the idea of me being a vagabond either. And other parents of other pilgrims also had quite serious concerns about what their adult children were getting involved in. And I think those qualms were generally laid to rest because our pilgrimage was the front page story of both the Seattle Times and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the two main daily papers in Seattle. And that said, okay, maybe this is real.
This is In Good Faith. We're speaking with James Patrick Thomas, author of Atomic Pilgrim. You can hear more stories about people pushed by their faith to solve contemporary problems in our In Good Faith archive. For example, Mark Miner on addiction recovery in episode 132, Rabbi Daniel Ruttenberg on forgiveness in episode 122, and the Muslim prison ministry Link Outside in episode 103. Find all our episodes on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube, and be sure and share an episode that's meant something to you with the people in your life. I'd love to talk almost page by page through the book, but I do have several highlights I want to hit. If you don't mind, for just a moment, I want to jump ahead to arriving in the Holy Land, not yet to Bethlehem, but arriving in the Holy Land. And this is 20 months of walking. This is just astounding to me. You get to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Nativity, and then you're actually lodging at St. Peter in Gallicantu, which is the church built over a possible place where the high priest's foundation of that building or palace was. And these dungeons down below, and there's one that at the time you could only be lowered down through a hole in the ceiling. And they've made a way for tourists to take a little staircase down there, but it's quite chilling. I know it's very personal, but could you share with me the feeling and the thought you had there?
Well, by the time we had gotten into Jerusalem, I'd been on the road for the better part of 2 years, and we were only 8 miles away from Bethlehem. And the only reason why I was there was because I had reached out to Jesus so many times on the road when it was difficult. And I'm not somebody who imagines things or imagines any kind of mystical experience. But in this dungeon, and for a while, I was the only one there. And it's not a big area. It's rather intimate, and it's all cased in rock. And as I sat there, I just had this feeling of a presence on my left side, as if this was Jesus sitting next to me. It was almost as if Jesus was preparing me or informing me that I would be continuing this way of bearing my cross and that it would continue to entail suffering after I got back home. But there was a real sense Jesus wouldn't leave me, that he would continue to help me bear my cross. And there was a deep peace with that.
When I take groups to Israel and we go into that pit via the stairs that now exist, there's a little stand like a lectern in one corner with Psalm 88 translated into, I don't know, 80 different languages. So whoever is there can flip through the pages and read it. It's quite powerful. And the first few stanzas say, I am counted among those who go down to the pit. I am like one without strength. I am set apart with the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, who are cut off from your care. You have put me in the lowest pit, in the darkest depths. It's always sobering to read that with a group, but picturing you there all by yourself, as you describe it, it seems like it would help you connect to the loneliness and the sacrifice of Jesus in a very personal way.
Thank you for sharing that, because the way you talk about that and share that in the book was really quite moving to me. And then you arrive at Bethlehem, and because I think it was Christmas Eve, literally.
It was Christmas Eve, yes.
There is no room in the inn for you.
No.
There was a precedent for that some centuries earlier. So tell me about, you end up spending the night where you do that, and then I think this is Father Benoît Charlemagne and what he says. Would you tell me about that?
Yeah, so Benoît was a French Capuchin priest who we met just happenstance or providential in Paris when we were walking by the Arc de Triomphe in downtown Paris. And Benoît is a character unto himself, and he comes with us all the way to Bethlehem. So he's taking part in this closing ceremony at Shepherd's Field on Christmas Eve. And in his very broken English, he shouts out, "We are here. It was a crazy idea, but we are here."
I just think of how many ideas people get that will help others that people say, "That's a crazy idea." And yet, I love what he said, by taking lots of little steps, we'll find ourselves saying, "We are here." And then you end up sleeping in sleeping bags on a roof because there's no place.
It was the roof of the Bethlehem Bible College. So we walked from Shepherd's Field back into Bethlehem, and that's where we stayed, just our sleeping bags out under the stars on Christmas night. It took me a long time to get to sleep that night. Well, number one, the stars were amazing. But part of me was just trying to grasp that we had done it. And then as the sun rose, we got up and we looked out over the parapet of the roof and we could see the sun shining on the town of Bethlehem. And then we went down to the street and walked to the church in the Nativity.
How old were you at the time you entered Bethlehem?
I was 28 or 29.
Okay, but then, so decades and decades have gone by, I think inspired by what you describe in this paragraph. I wonder, would you read that starting with writing this book?
Yes. Writing this book was a wonderful adventure, much like the epic journey of walking to Bethlehem. I discovered that my pilgrimage through life has been more than a search for peace. I have pursued the truth about myself as well as the human cost of America amassing its vast arsenal of nuclear weapons. Through decades of work, hundreds of companions, and years of investigation, I feel invigorated by this truth. Living one's life for others is a stupendous joy.
That is quite a paragraph to me and describes what you have done since, which you describe in the final third of the book, that you find out environmentally what had been happening and covered up by the government. You discover that as a boy in Montana, you had been very close to the most nuclear pollution that had happened in the continental U.S. And then you just help uncover this. This feeling, I mean, do you feel like God prepared you for this, or this was a mission he gave you, or was it something that you decided to do and then were supported in moving forward?
I can't know it. I think it's all God's grace. It's all been a blessing. I think the pilgrimage certainly prepared me for my work unraveling the secrets of the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State. When I got back to my parents' house in Spokane in 1984, there was very little information about Hanford. I read just a couple of lines in the Spokane paper about the resumption of plutonium operations at Hanford to supply plutonium for the nuclear weapons in Reagan's nuclear weapons buildup in the 1980s. And, you know, Hanford was one of the original Manhattan Project sites. It produced the plutonium that was in the bomb that destroyed Nagasaki. That was about the only thing we knew about Hanford in 1984. There wasn't information available to the public about what happened at Hanford. And I got together, actually, it was a sermon by a Unitarian minister in Spokane, Bill Houff, who kind of sparked a study group within his congregation about low-level radiation and Hanford. Within a few weeks after that sermon, they had put an article or invitation in the Spokane Peace and Justice newsletter, opening up this group to anybody in the community who wanted to learn more about radiation and more about Hanford. And so I started meeting with them And together, we started to prepare a Freedom of Information Act request demanding access to records that were then secret, saying, you know, we as citizens have a right to these records about a program that could be impacting our health. Spokane was only about 120 miles or so downwind of Hanford, and many people were closer in than that. So we wanted to find out, and we were joined by journalists throughout the Northwest, as well as Native American tribes, and we were successful in getting the first 19,000 pages released from Hanford about the 40 years of operations since 1945. We were thinking we would find, you know, maybe some severe accidents, like something akin to what happened at Three Mile Island. And we were just blown away by the reality that, no, almost all of Hanford's environmental releases were done as a result of routine operations with everything in the plant operating as designed. Part of that was they didn't have any filters on the stacks for the first 3 years at Hanford. And then subsequently, as I dug further and further into the records, I found out they knew in 1945 how dangerous it was. And what is more, they knew things that could have protected people, such as using iodized salt or taking potassium iodide tablets. But the government at Hanford and its contractors hid behind an iron curtain of secrecy and didn't tell anybody until in 1986 when the documents were released.
And so many people who suffered ill effects that could have been avoided in many cases if it had just been known.
Even given people's exposure to the radiation, if they had known about it 10 or 20 years earlier, many of them could have been treated earlier and not have to have their lives interrupted by cancer or their lives ended early by dying of those cancers.
I learned something about you and your activism from just seeing over your shoulder a picture of Martin Luther King Jr. And in that photo on the wall behind him is Mahatma Gandhi, and highest on the wall, a crucifix, the figure of Jesus. I'm impressed with your mixture of activism, how it ties in with faith. I wonder if I could just ask, did you always have a faith in God and always believe from an early age?
Yeah, I'm a cradle Catholic. I love going to church. When I was in grade school, I attended Mass many times during the week, and I've always had this amazing devotion to God. And then in high school, the effects of the Second Vatican Council were starting to make their impact. And my religion teachers at Gonzaga Prep in Spokane gave me a sense of not just Jesus the Christ, but Jesus as a person, a real person who walked the earth. And subsequent to that, I learned of Jesus the activist. Jesus did not sit idly by. He engaged the people of his time. He went out to the byways, and especially with the religious authorities of his time, actively confronted them with their hypocrisy. And so when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, it was very much the safe Jesus, the divine Jesus that was somewhere up there in heaven. But both starting in high school, but especially during the pilgrimage and afterwards, I saw Jesus as one who wasn't just a social reformer, but trying to get people to realize the immense miracle each of us are, the immense manifestation of God's love that every single person is, and how wondrous that is. And that's why it's so sad and really an offense against God to have people living in situations in poverty, in ignorance, in oppression. You know, look right now at the situation in Gaza. It just must be bringing abundant tears to God's eyes to have this happening in the Holy Land now. It's just so, so sad.
Well, thank you so much for writing the book. Thank you for what motivated it. And I'm going to be thinking for a while of your author's note. I feel invigorated by this truth. Living one's life for others is a stupendous joy. The book is Atomic Pilgrim, How Walking Thousands of Miles for Peace Led to Uncovering Some of America's Darkest Nuclear Secrets. And we have left out beautiful stories all the way across the U.S., arriving in Ireland, and we've got Greece and Hungary and places along the way that I just want to say, what a great writer I think you are and how you drew my interest and held it the whole time. Just well done.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Anything I should have asked that we didn't get to? Thank you so much for what you've shared.
Well, I think for us as Christians is to surrender to the cross. You know, Jesus did not say to us, there won't be any suffering. Quite the opposite. He said, pick up your cross every day and follow me. What we tend to want to focus on is the suffering part. And we lose sight that there is reward in that suffering. And the reward is this absolutely astounding, powerful joy that comes along with it. There's a joy that comes in living the truth that has enabled me to sustain that over so many years.
Many thanks to James Patrick Thomas for speaking with me. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley. Our production team also includes Heidi Clough, Nick Levitt, and Ocean Marshall. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds. In fact, we believe people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, in Good Faith.
Hi, I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of In Good Faith. Nothing captivates me more than people setting out on an adventure, especially if it's a place I wish I could go to or a subject I wish I knew more about, but I don't live in the right place or I don't have the equipment or the expertise. I'm telling you about a podcast from our BYU Radio family of podcasts, an award-winning podcast called Constant Wonder. With host Marcus Smith, you'll be expanding your horizons on all kinds of discovery. It could be science, it could be art, history, and more. Do you need that feeling of awe and wonder in your life more? I do, and I love it when I see how to experience that by hearing the stories of people who are doing and exploring all of those things that are so interesting to me. Check out the podcast, Constant Wonder.